Hi, and welcome to another episode of Chatter, a podcast from The Gist. Now, on today's show, we're talking to Dennis Campbell. He's the editor of UK Progressives and one of the hosts of the Three Muckrakers podcast. He's got some pretty interesting insights into what the fate of Theresa May will be, whether she'll survive conference season, and of the repercussions of Brexit. It's definitely one of the most interesting conversations I've had in quite a while, and I really hope you enjoy it. So here it is. So it's nice to have you on the show, Dennis.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, it's lovely to be able to talk to you on this rainy August day in Northern Ireland anyway. How's the...
Yeah, it's raining here too in Wales.
Well, at least it's consistent. Anyway, just to jump right in, you were talking there about how long Theresa May will last. I had quite an extensive discussion with a good friend of mine about how personally I think that Corbyn will be the next elected Prime Minister of the UK, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be the next Prime Minister. So, you know, how long do you think Theresa May can last?
Well, you have to sort of look back a little bit at the history of what we've seen so far. And, you know, she took the gamble of having a snap election. By all accounts, she should have won that snap election quite easily. Should have walked away with a close to 100-seat majority, which would have given her the power and the party the power to do anything. And the simple fact of the matter is they lost terribly. I look at my own former party, the party that I stood for in 2016, and as a member, a hopeful member of the Welsh Assembly, I was unsuccessful, the Liberal Democrats. They did not do anywhere near the recovery number of seats they had expected, and their leader resigned. The Tories did not get close to the number of seats they projected. Indeed, they lost their true majority and had to enter into a power sharing agreement with the Democratic Unionist Party. And that created a whole new interesting set of problems for Mrs. May and the Tories, because you generally don't get yourself involved in the internal politics and affairs or pick a side in Northern Ireland. That's, as you know, living there, a political suicide.
Yes.
So, that said, she's been hiding. I'm sorry, she's been walking through the mountains for the last month. The Brexit situation is falling apart before her very eyes. There's complete disagreement amongst members of her cabinet. And you can sense that the knives are already out for her. And it is simply a matter of time. I mean, she's planning to go on telly before the conference and beg the members of the party to give her another chance and keep her in control. And that's never a position of strength, nor is it a position of strength when you start going to the European Union to negotiate the exit terms. So, how long will she last? That's as long as a piece of string. But the signs are not good. The knives are out, and I don't think she stands a particularly good chance of survive.
I take your point about how the knives are out, but honestly, I struggle to see where or who is going to replace Theresa, because ultimately that front bench is full of a whole lot of people who are just as, if not more, toxic than Theresa May is as Prime Minister. Philip Hammond, oh, but, you know, Boris Johnson.
Jacob Rees-Mogg is going to come in and save the day, right?
The fact that that's even being floated shows how poor the front bench is in terms of how they think they would do as leaders of the party. And with the Fixed Term Parliament Act there, it means that she's in a, well, at least the Conservatives are in a much stronger position in terms of they have more sort of leeway to be able to hang on than, say, they would have done 10 years ago
if they had had such a slim majority and, you know, had been, they would have been facing a lot tougher challenge on no confidence votes, because the Fixed Term Parliament Act narrowed down the different ways in which the government can be dissolved, and also the different ways in which you can end up with a snap election. So I honestly foresee a situation in which Theresa May can cling on until 2022, at which point, like, 100% she'd be gone. There's no way, I think, that her credibility can go back up from where it is now. I think it's more of a case of, do the Tories want to risk ousting another leader and installing someone who could be, again, just as unpopular, and then all of a sudden they're back in the situation where they were 12 months ago, where they have a leader who wasn't elected by the public. So I'm curious more than anything as to see where it goes. Who do you see as the replacement?
I'm not certain. We joked about Jacob Rees-Mogg, but he's always a person that is lurking on the sidelines. It's certainly not going to be Boris Johnson. I mean, he's completely messed up the Home Office, not the Home Office, but the Foreign Service Office. So you've only got one or two possible candidates, neither of which is a household name. Philip Hammond has always been described as the moderate member of the Tories, and I think he thinks he would do much better, but they're facing an avalanche of bad economic news when they come back in September. Even for Donald Trump in the United States, who's been talking about how great the stock market is, it's not going to be great. You're going to have a Black Monday some point in time in September or October. You're going to see 10% of the market or more fall off. You've got a housing bubble. You've got a personal credit bubble. You've got a story I wrote for UK Progressive. I was literally getting my tires changed on my car and it was late in the afternoon because, you don't want to spend the whole day sitting in a garage waiting for someone to service it. And there was this guy who had one of these big Mercedes Sprinter Transit type vans. And he was getting a new set of tires, so we started chatting because I couldn't figure out what his business was from the logo. He said, we move pets. From when you move house and you don't want Fido to get lost or go running away, or Fifi the cat or whatever, they said, we come in and we take care of the whole move for your pets. And he said they've had the busiest summer ever. He's got 5 vans all over Europe now transporting pets from point A to point B. And so that's interesting. And he said, well, I said, so is it just normal for this time of year? He said, no. He said, there's a huge online retailer that just moved its top 11 people in all of Europe from the UK to Prague in Czechoslovakia. And of course, now my ears are perked up and I'm thinking, this is an interesting story. Mm-hmm. Really? He said, yeah, one guy, the second in command, they moved him so quickly, they literally had to pay £30,000 to buy out his luxury auto lease because, where he was going, he had to get a left drive auto. And he started to tell me all these little, anecdotal sort of stories. And I was thinking, this is really interesting. He said, oh, yeah. He says, we've also moved several of the top hedge fund managers. They're going to Paris. They're going to Brussels. They're going to Frankfurt. And I thought, this is interesting. And I said, and the more I thought about this, I thought, yeah, this actually makes sense. Business cannot stand uncertainty of any kind. It takes a while to change operations, start up new, wind down here, move the people this summer, give them the time to get in and get settled, move the operations next summer. And before you know it, no matter what the outcome of Brexit is, the economy is screwed. And they're already talking inflation of 2.5%, wage growth of only 1%, you know, GDP of less than 2%, GDP growth of less than 2%. Economically, this is going to be a disaster. It's going to leave the UK poorer. It's going to leave the UK without the resources it needs. And you're going to see a massive sector, the banking sector, with the ripple-on effect of that, move to Europe, because nobody wants to be stuck on a tiny little island in the middle of the Atlantic freaking ocean that has decided it's going to go all protectionist all by itself.
Yeah, it's not exactly like a particularly rosy looking future at the minute. But let me play devil's advocate for a minute, because someone we had on the podcast, actually, we did the interview last week, and the recording is going to go out on Tuesday, and he was making the case that, I'm not sure if you saw the polling that was done, I think a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was even sooner than that, that like a majority of Brexit voters were happy to take economic damage to see some people lose their jobs just for Brexit to be pushed through and to get it done, essentially. They were willing to take those sort of sacrifices. And a lot of people sort of blew up and said that they were martyrs, that they were crazy people who were just, you know, self-sabotaging. And Bill, my friend who we spoke to, he actually offered a sort of counter to that and said that he feels that in the very long term, that ultimately we're better off out of Europe. And his reasoning was that because of the way the euro's going, in terms of it's very difficult to manage fiscally, that many different countries with so many different sort of economic situations, it means it's all, you're always going to come out with sort of economic losses, countries doing much worse than others, that German and French banks are just currently propping up a lot of the economies of Greece and of Italy. And that he felt that economically it was a ticking time bomb, and that because of that, then if we were politically associated, that we would be drawn into paying quite a hefty bill, or at least a hefty price economically ourselves, having to deal with that. And that he felt that in the long run, if Brexit was dealt with well, that we would come out better off. Now, whether it is being dealt with well is a completely different matter, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, there's your key phrase there. If Brexit was dealt with well. You know, we have a bunch of rank amateurs. I mean, just before we went on this long summer break, David Davis showed up for a one-hour meeting in Brussels and then walked off, and that was the last anybody's ever heard or seen. When we started this process, we had a grand total of 5 negotiators for all of the UK, for all of the economic sectors. We may have a couple more now, but we certainly don't have the breadth and depth of the operations they have. And the last point I would say on your friend's assertion that we're better off out is, it don't matter whether we're in or out. Market contagion, global markets, if the euro goes under, the world goes under.
Mm.
So it's not just going to be us that's paying, it's going to be everyone around the world, because you cannot have a 300 million person economy, essentially, go tits up because a couple of countries can't pay their bills. There will be a way, and even if we're going to pay in one form or another, either in higher inflation, higher prices, less capital available, whatever it is, we don't get away just by getting away. And economically, a lot of people don't understand that.
No, that's a totally fair point. So you're essentially suggesting that regardless of whether we have political economic union with them directly, that just because of the proximity and our sort of integration with Europe and through trade and whatnot, whether it's tariff-free, whether it's we're in the single market, or whether, you know, we're hopefully not, but if we're on World Trade Organization tariffs, you think that there's no way we can escape that? Would you say then it's better to be in there trying to make a difference? Or
yes, I mean, Cameron really screwed the pooch on this. I mean, he had absolutely no clue what he was doing. He said he was going to go off and, you know, set the Europe straight or else come back and recommend we have a referendum. Remember the days back in the day, 2014, 2015.
Oh, I know.
And
I remember it
you
fondly.
Know, the guy basically did what May did and walked into a room with 27 other nations and said, this is the way it's going to be. We're the United Kingdom. The sun shall never set on the British Empire. And screw you and whatever it is you want. And I think what has happened now is the reality is beginning to sink in. You have 27 countries, any one of whom can veto any deal, all of whom want us dead for causing this upset. And they'll do anything in their power to leave us crippled. And there is no freaking Marshall Plan coming to help the UK when this is all over. So yeah, maybe 10, 15 years when we recover. But I don't want to do that to my kids. You know, I don't want to do that to my future, my retirement. I don't want to do that to anybody. To put everything up in the air so we can be, quote, free, when it looks like freedom will end up us having to pay more money to access the markets that we already access to get the same situation we have now by staying inside the union. I don't see the sense in that anywhere.
No, I'm very much in agreement with you on a lot of those things. But you mentioned the Marshall Plan there, which kind of takes me on to something else I wanted to ask you about, which was the purported trade deal between the UK and the US. Because honestly, I think it's all just a lot of hot air, because ultimately, as you've said, that you don't think Theresa May will last even past conference season. And our future is very much up in the air at the minute. And Trump is staring down the barrel of several different investigations from the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and from Robert Mueller. So I'm skeptical as whether either of them will last until 2019, at which point I think that there's ultimately no point in getting worked up about the potentials of a trade deal when it's very, very feasible that neither leader will be in place when it comes to negotiating them.
Yeah. You know, I have said this repeatedly. You've got a man in Donald Trump who tells an average of 4.6 lies per day and has for over 200 days. So do the math. It's over 1,000 lies since he took office. He refused yesterday to denounce white nationalists and neo-Nazis. He basically is one of the most cancerous, venomous people walking on the planet. He almost makes Bashar al-Assad look approachable because of his behavior. And that is a horrible thing for anyone to have to say, because I'm half American and I'm half British, to think that the leader of my birth country is a complete psychopath. And when he says we can do a deal very, very, very quickly, it isn't going to happen very, very, very quickly. And he's not going to do a trade deal that's going to do anything but favor the United States, especially after his bluff and bluster over NAFTA, his canceling of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and everything else that he's trying to do to show that he is the anti-Obama. So what makes Theresa May think that she can trust him other than they both have one thing, a desperate need for a win to hopefully survive. And I can't see either the U.S. Congress or even the House of Parliament voting on a deal that isn't a win, and we're stalemate and stuck right where we were with no trading partners and no idea what the fuck we're going to do.
Yeah, it's really difficult just to try and get a grasp on what the next couple of years will bring. In any situation, like I really envy the Germans, just not for their economic success or.
Well, Angela Merkel is the leader of the free world right now.
Yeah, and it looks like she's gonna win again and get reelected, in the elections in September. They're polling about, I think, 15 or 20 points ahead, and understandably she's principled. She's fair, and you know, whether you disagree with her own way that she's dealt with Europe as a whole, in terms of very much making Germany the center of Europe in every that's her goals anyway, and that's exactly what Germans want, and she's doing a far better job of it than Trump is doing of putting America first.
And she did a hell of a job tackling the dissent and the structure and the stodginess inside of her own party. She made her own party better, which is how she got elected in the first place, and that continues to go well for her.
I couldn't agree more. Her stance on the gay marriage vote in Germany was, I thought, one of the most admirable things I'd seen in politics. She doesn't personally agree with it, but she doesn't want to let her own views stand in the way of, you know, democracy, and she just let the vote go ahead, voted against it, and people are entitled to their opinions as long as they don't let that cloud their judgment in terms of what's politically right. So I think she's a lot of things going for her that both Theresa May and Donald Trump could probably learn a lot from. But you also mentioned actually there Charlottesville and the Trump's refusal to condemn what was quite obviously a neo-Nazi white supremacist protest. And I wanted to see, I've heard this suggestion from a couple of people, that Trump's refusal to condemn it and his sort of "I condemn violence from all sides" was in a way very similar to Corbyn's refusal to condemn the IRA specifically, or President Maduro specifically. I wanted to get your opinion on that take, whether you think that there are similarities that can be drawn there, or whether that's, you know, there's obviously clear differences. What do you think?
Well, I'm literally opening on my computer a slate, which I'll read to you, which ran this morning at 7 o'clock, 7:09 a.m. on Fox News this morning. All right? And it's a full page, it's a full screen slate. It says Fox News, and "Neo-Nazi website praises Trump response." That's the headline. Underneath it says the quote from Andrew Anglin, editor of the Daily Stormer, and it was said today. And by the way, the Daily Stormer has 24 hours to find a new hosting site for their website, because GoDaddy has said, "You're done. You violated our terms of services," so you understand that, okay? Mm-hmm. The quote is, "Trump's comments were good. He didn't attack us. When asked to condemn, he just walked out of the room. Really, really good. God bless him."
Yeah, I think that's quite horrifying, really.
Yeah, and he would look at that as a good thing. You know, the simple fact that he didn't, I was reading a couple of things this morning, where it's just the basic leadership failure of him to address all of the things that have gone wrong with this. You know, he has an opportunity. He says he's going to hold a pretty big press conference on Monday. But is he going to follow through? I mean, why didn't he denounce the white nationalists over the weekend? displayed the egregious display of hatred, bigotry, violence on many sides. That's an actual quote. His suggestion, though, of an equivalence of blame left him on an island. And lawmakers in his own party are criticizing his response. And the White House is supposed to be the place where the president sets the tone and leads everything going forward. And you cannot look at situations. I mean, Clinton was out there bringing people together after essentially a white supremacist, white nationalist blew up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. 9/11, George Bush was out there bringing people together, urging tolerance towards Muslims, etc., after 9/11. You saw President Obama, after the Columbia shooting of the pastor and others, out there bringing us together. And what has happened is that Donald Trump has failed this incredible litmus test. And what he does when he's backed into a corner is he doesn't admit his mistake, he never apologizes, and in fact, he doubles down. I mean, go all the way back to the Central Park Five in 1989. He took out a full-page advert, $85,000 in the New York Times, you know, calling for return of the death penalty, basically convicting these guys through the media. And then 14 years after their sentences were vacated because of DNA evidence, Mr. Trump basically doubled down with more accusations instead of saying these were the wrong people that were arrested. They should never have been charged. And no one can see how he's going to change now. I mean, he's got to stand up and be presidential at some point, yet I don't see it happening. He's more concerned about pitting people against each other inside of the West Wing of the White House. And you know, having worked in the White House and having worked as a member of the press there, it is a bubble that you have got to somehow get out of or it will consume you. And right now the bubble is consuming him. I mean, the attacks right now on General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, are stunning. And yet he showed the most class of any member of the administration yesterday on television's Meet the Press. I'm reading from Chuck Todd's interview because it was an amazing exchange. Todd said, "Can you and Steve Bannon still work together in this White House or not?" McMaster, "Well, I get to work together with a broad range of talented people, and it's a privilege every day to enable the national security team." And Todd said, "You didn't answer. Can you and Steve Bannon work together in the same White House?" McMaster, "I am. I'm ready to work with anyone who will help advance the president's agenda and advance the security, prosperity of the American people." "Do you believe Steve Bannon does that?" "Well, I believe that everyone who works in the White House who has the privilege, the great privilege every day of serving their nation, should be motivated by that goal." He is following the rule my mother espoused all my life. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything. That's precisely what he did there. These guys have had their knives out for him. And not just him, but Breitbart Media, all of the right-wing press, have been trying to get rid of him because he's the adult in the room who, along with General Kelly, have the ear of the president at this moment. But neither of them have been able to take away his goddamn telephone and stop him from tweeting.
That's unfortunately, I think, never going to happen. I don't think anyone will prize the Android unless it's from his cold, dead fingers. But anyway.
I mean, he attacked the head of Merck this morning. We're taping on what day is this? Monday.
Monday the 14th.
And, you know, the head of Merck withdrew from his economic advisory team along with Elon Musk today. Mm, this is a black gentleman, African-American, who is absolutely furious with the fact that he did not come out and denounce the white nationalists and the neo-Nazis or the Charlottesville in the strongest of terms. And he said, "I cannot be a part of this." I mean, there was actually a statement. I can't find that in a matter of seconds. But, you know, by quitting this, he's also come under attack, literally, within the last few minutes. President Trump has been doubling down in less than an hour. Now that Ken Frazier from Merck has resigned from the President's Manufacturing Council, he'll have more time to lower rip-off drug prices. Lower rip-off drug prices is in all caps, exclamation point.
So I'd love to see that.
That is, I mean...
Not that I think that's his, a big thing on his agenda.
It's misdirection, it's false equivalency, it's everything you could possibly imagine. Instead of coming out and addressing the issue, Merck CEO Ken Frazier said, America's leaders must honor our fundamental views by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy, which can run counter to the American ideal that all people are created equal. That's what he said in his post saying that he resigned. And less than an hour later, Trump did what he just did, and he did it on Twitter, his favorite attack meme. I mean, the man is mentally unwell.
Well, that's actually something I wanted to ask was, where do you think the line gets drawn between Trump's being a genius in misdirection and manipulation of people in his... So in his attacks against people, everyone essentially that opposes him or says anything contrary to him, how much do you think that is him being like a master manipulator and knowing that his base doesn't want him to back down on anything and that's what they love about him? And how much do you think is sort of a paranoid, just reactionary, well, child just lashing out at the world when it's not how he wants it to be? Like, where do you think the line is there? Or is there one? Is it completely one or the other?
I'm not sure there is a line with him. You know, the weekend daily tracking poll came out. And this means that for an entire month now, Donald Trump has had an approval rating of less than 40%. That's the first time that's happened in his presidency. An entire month, he's gone up and down, you know, sometimes as high as 42 or 43, but he's been under 40 now on the Gallup tracking poll for an entire month, and that's never happened before. His core support among Republicans at the start of his administration was 73%. It's now 59%. His support amongst Republicans in general has dropped below 50 for the first time. He's seeing all independents going rapidly in the other direction. There's been a massive swing there. Of course, Democrats have always been, you know, or left-leaning people have always been against him. But all of this begins to take a toll. And the single fact beyond just temperament and Twitter and all that is that he hasn't done a damn thing. He's not passed a single piece of his legislative agenda.
I honestly think that's his biggest weakness.
Yeah.
Is that they haven't got anything that they can point at yet. They haven't got any, this is what we're doing, apart from the travel ban and a couple of executive orders. They have no, like, distracting thing that they can point to and be like, yes, we've been successful here.
Let me play this for you, because he's already got a campaign advert out. I'll pop the speakers up.
Okay.
Because this thing will blow your mind when you hear it. Basically, his re-election campaign released a TV advert which criticizes his enemies for not wanting him to succeed. It focuses on journalists and includes several Democratic lawmakers, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Elizabeth Warren, and Republican lawmakers. And the campaign didn't respond to any requests for more details, when it will air, how much it will cost, whatever. But this is what's coming.
Democrats obstructing. The media attacking our president. Career politicians standing in the way of success. But President Trump's plan is working. 1 million jobs created. More Americans working than ever before. Unemployment lowest since 2001. The stock market, all-time record highs. The strongest military in decades. The president's enemies don't want him to succeed. But Americans are saying, let President Trump do his job.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
I mean, that's insanity. Number one, he hasn't even been in the office for 6 full months. Well, what day is it? No, he's still got a week to go. No, he has been, January to July, not even for 7 full months. And he's already running 3.5 years out for re-election in 2020 using tactics like this. He hasn't done anything. All of the claims that were made in that, if you remember all the way back to 2008, now it might be a bit of a stretch for you, I do remember, but in 2008, when the economy was about to crater in September of that year, just before the presidential election, and you were losing 750,000 jobs a month in the U.S. economy, everybody was saying, oh, my God, this is terrible. And for the first 6 months of Obama's tenure, the economy still belonged to the previous guy.
Yeah.
The economy is just now starting to switch over to Trump. And all of the claims that he's made about the stock market, it went from 7,000 points up to 20,000 points under President Obama. The last 10% to 22,000 where we are right now is technically while he was in office, but it's not even anywhere near as big a jump as what was witnessed over the previous 8 years. Talks about 1 million new jobs. Well, yeah, I mean, the economy's been doing 200,000 jobs roughly a month, just slightly under, for the last 6.5 years. So to suddenly say that it's his economy, but the big, the piece de resistance was, well, the way he said, just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, I mean, today's Monday, so it would have been Thursday or Wednesday of last week. He said, completely out of the blue, I ordered a complete revamping of our nuclear capabilities. And it's done. Congratulations, blah, 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 blah. We are now stronger and safer. And everybody called that one out as complete and total bullshit because Obama had ordered a modernization of the nuclear silos, the nuclear fleets, the nuclear protections, the computer systems, etc. It's a 30-year plan. It just got started 2 years ago, yet Trump is going to try and take credit for that. He's expanding the military. Well, he's throwing a lot of money at it, but I don't know that he's actually expanding it. And when he started last week to threaten Venezuela, you know, that you're going to go and attack, I mean, the predictable response and the pissing match he has had with Kim Jong-un over nuclear weapons has terrified everybody on the island of Guam, as well as Japan, as well as the Philippines, as well as China. He's been very quiet, by the way, you may have noticed this week. But still, where does this all end? And he just wants to take credit for anything that makes him look good. It is so narcissistic in the West Wing and so narcissistic in the White House.
I couldn't agree more in that he's just grasping around for something to sort of latch onto as something as a success. I'm looking at the 538 approval tracker for Trump, and it's been, according to their averages, he's been below 40% since May 16th. which is shocking. But he's still sitting at 37.5% approvals. And actually, on the 538 podcast, I think it was last week, they were talking about how when Nixon was impeached, he was still polling at 25%. That one in four Americans still believe Nixon was doing a good job when he was like on the verge of being impeached or prosecuted when he resigned, essentially.
Well,
the
big difference between that, though, was that it was his own party. that told him there was no way he was going to survive it.
Hmm. But that's because I think he'd become a liability to the party.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the moment, Trump isn't there yet. He may be, in the very long run, a liability to the party, because I can't count how many different stories I've seen where people are just saying, I will never vote Republican again, or I will never vote Republican, I will not even consider it. And while I think that's maybe not the smartest statement to make on people's behalf, because you can never quite say what's going to happen, they've turned off like such huge swathes of the population that even if they manage to hang on in 2018, I'm not sure if they can hold the House or not. No. It's looking like they probably won't. But the Senate, they will hold. I think there's not enough seats up for grabs in 2018 for them to take.
Well, it's a bigger lift in the Senate. It always is.
Mm.
The question, though, is what are the Democrats doing? You know, we recorded our podcast today on Monday because we got tired of recording on Friday morning and then literally having it outdated by the time people paid attention to it Monday. So we just put it up live so that people can actually listen to it. We did a second podcast, one on Friday and one on Monday. And Paul did a piece on who is this guy, Mike Pence. But then I also had a piece in there on the Democrats not necessarily being a slam dunk for 2018, because there's civil war inside the party right now between the so-called Bernie bros, you know, those that follow Bernie, and Bernie or bust and never Hillary's, and the more centrist wing of the party. So it's kind of like the Blairites versus Corbyn in respect. And they're not doing anything to go after the largest group of disenfranchised swing voters, and that is the uneducated, non-college-educated white male voter.
Hmm.
That is where Trump crushed in his election. These people who were basically like UKIPers, who said, I'm fed up, I'm sick and tired of being told one thing, I'm sick and tired of not seeing any progress, I'm sick and tired of there not being anything happening. So, I don't know.
Well,
I think it's going to be very interesting unless they can come up with a compelling campaign slogan other than "We're not Trump."
Well, they have their better deal that they're coming out with at the minute. But to that point, I think that first of all, that Sanders had a much larger overlap with that sort of voter than Hillary Clinton did. Now, whether he would have actually beaten Trump is a whole other kettle of fish and something we can never really say for sure. But I feel that the center wing of the Democratic Party are going to lose this fight, whether it's now or whether it's in 10 years' time. I think eventually they're going to lose this battle whereby the party has sort of shifted, I think, from being that sort of white working class, like grassroots for the people party, to being bought essentially in a lot of cases by the corporate interest. And whether that's because they are forced to pander to these to the money essentially in order to compete with Republicans who are getting bankrolled by like hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think eventually that people are becoming more and more and more resistant to that idea. And
yeah, they just don't want to. You know, if you look at the leadership right now of both parties, these are people in their 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And they're completely out of tune and out of touch with younger voters, millennials.
Well, I would argue Sanders is pretty in touch with the younger voters.
Yes and no. I mean, he's still an establishment politician at the end of the day. He who knows how to say the right things. That's a big difference. And that helps him in many different ways. The problem is that the new young voices of the party, and when I say Elizabeth Warren, and she's not young either, she's in her 60s.
68.
But she's younger than the Pelosis and the Hoyers and the Chuck Schumers and others who have been doing this, you know, for 10, 15 years, even beyond where she is. But Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, the young up-and-comers have got to be given a chance to get out there without being shot down by the far-left party.
With Kamala Harris, I would agree with you. With Cory Booker, I would say he's not had his chance, but he needs to do something to revamp his reputation. Because, for example, there was that drugs reimportation bill that Sanders had, or amendment that Sanders had put forward at the start of the year, and he voted against it, and he had no he didn't give any substantive reason for why he wanted to vote against it. Some of his biggest donors are in the pharmaceutical industry, and whether that's the exact reason that he voted for it or not, that's the impression that it gives off. And
say the same thing about pretty much anybody. Okay?
I know, I completely
money,
agree.
Money talks.
It does talk.
The moment you're elected, you've got to raise $1.3 million a week for one purpose only, that's to get reelected. So I'd rather talk about the corruption of the system rather than someone doing what they have to do, what they think they have to do to stay alive, if you know what I mean.
Because the system is
completely corrupted by money. And it's not going anywhere. So I'm not about to let the Democrats tie one arm behind their back to be pure in the eyes of some voters. You know, if that's the rules under which they have to operate. I mean,
I don't know if that is the rules anymore because neither Trump or Sanders, like arguably the two candidates that provoked the biggest reaction and the most rabid fan bases, neither of them were reliant on corporate donations. Trump, because he was able to manipulate the media and use some of his own money, but I struggle to believe that Trump was pouring a lot of his own money into the campaign.
No, he didn't pour any, and in fact he turned it into a profit center. His campaign
made
money for him. He's a different case, but you know, don't also think that Bernie's pure as the driven snow. He's taken a lot of corporate money as well. They have to do it to survive. Yes, he was very successful in the primaries in his presidential run in getting the message out and getting small donor donations. But I can tell you that the latest filing, FEC filing, just came out, and it showed that the Republicans going into 2018 and this cycle have double the amount of money that the Democrats had because of all the infighting. There's $75 million in the bank today for the Republicans versus $38 million in the bank today for the Democrats. And the Democrats are suffering because they cannot get a coherent, cohesive message out there. The one reason why Trump has survived is that he is fundraising gold for anybody who he supports. And the dilemma is, do I cut off my nose and criticize him knowing it will cost me money and support amongst his rabid base, or do I try to appeal to the more moderate Goldwater Republican? And the answer so far is they can't do it at the moment without him, because his base is still very, very strong. They come out early, they vote in primaries, whereas the more moderate wing doesn't, you know, 20% of the party members come out and vote in primaries. This is why Jeff Flake is likely to be unsuccessful in his reelection. He won't even make it out of the primary. It's the Arizona senator, despite writing a book. And it just goes on and on. So, I mean, Republicans have this massive problem. If I go against Trump and stand on principle, I alienate the Trumpsters. I could be primaried. My funding will dry up, and there's not much I can do. If I support Trump, I have to hold my nose, look the other way, and pretend I don't see when he does what he did yesterday in Charlottesville, but I'll have money and I'll likely survive. That's the political system right now, and it sucks.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. To be honest, I think we're seeing a couple of Republican senators especially starting to stand up to him. There's Lisa Murkowski, John McCain, and Lindsey Graham. But I think the thing that ties the three of them together is they're not beholden to the Trump base. Murkowski was a write-in. McCain just is essentially, I don't think he's, well, it'd be very unlikely that he'll run for another term as senator. And Lindsey Graham was always anti-Trump, and I think that his voters know that, and he works well for them.
The only one that stands a chance is a name you hear every so often. He was in the primaries for about 10 minutes before he got knocked out. Governor of Ohio, John Kasich.
Hmm.
He has been the anti-Trump. He has been the most vocal critic. He seems the most sane. He's just as dangerous as the rest of them, but he seems the most sane of the alternatives out there. And it's going to be very interesting to watch, because even if Trump resigns, you get Pence. And Pence has had a rash of issues. I mean, Paul did a great segment today on the Three Muckrakers podcast talking about Pence. Who is he? What has he done? And, stuff I knew but was shocking to most people here in the British Isles and all our listeners, because they don't really know who this guy is. And when you learn who he is and you see what he's done and you see, you know, how tied he is to the evangelical, far, far right Christian wing of the Republican Party, what he attempted to do and how it hurt the economy of Indiana, where he's from, it just becomes massive. And then there's no room for dissent, you know, there. And it's going to be, you know, and he's just as dirty. He's tied up in this Russia thing as well. So,
yeah, I think, well, we'll have to see if he's implicated or not in the investigation. But on that note, I think we're going to have to wrap up. It's been fantastic having you on. I've really enjoyed our chat.
Pleasure being here.
We'll have all of the articles or interviews we talked about linked in the description. And yeah, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Don't forget to share us on Facebook, Twitter, or any form of social media. You can spread us by word of mouth. You can rate us. You'll find us on iTunes now. Until next week, goodbye.